Right, so I'll thank you for the invitation, Gus, and I'm going to tell you a bit about what we figured out what you can do with quantum expanders. Because classical expanders are very useful for many things, quantum expanders not so much. So here, you're going to get two applications. It's going to be a story about when you have a system and you divide it in a half, and then possibly these halves communicate just a little bit or maybe even less. What can you then tell about the state of the whole system? And in the first place, the first thing that I'm going to tell you is that I'm going to take one part of the system, have it interact with a tiny piece, send the piece to the other side, have it interact with the other part of the system, and then afterwards measuring this little thing, and if it comes out right, I'm going to certify that these two parts of the system were very entangled, actually maximally entangled. And this is a surprising thing because I was only sending a small thing across. And then the second thing, it's going to be static, not dynamical as a protocol, is going to be a system which interacts through a tiny little thing in the middle. The system is going to be gapped, and still the ground state is going to be very entangled. So one thing is going to be a dynamical protocol, and the second thing is going to be a ground state property. And it's all based on quantum expanders. So the story will be, first I'll tell you what these are about, how you construct them, and what their properties are. Then I'm going to give you the dynamical protocol for testing entanglement in a system that takes very little communication. And then the last thing is going to be a counterexample to the generalized area law, or actually the generalized area conjecture that we came up with, and then we shot down with this example of a really strange system with a really entangled ground state. So let's go into quantum expanders. To start with that, I'll go with classical expanders. How many of you know how to construct classical expanders and what they are? All right, so classical expanders are graphs that when you walk on them, they mix really fast. So you, on a graph like this, you start somewhere, you move, make a couple steps, and pretty much you could be anywhere and forget where you started. The funny thing is that it actually doesn't have to be super connected. When you look at this graph, every vertex has just three neighbors. So you can mix on graphs that are huge, even though there are a few connections in it. And actually a constant number of connections. So in particular, these graphs have a couple of nice properties. One thing is that when you divide the vertices into two groups, then the edges that you have cut between these groups, there are not few of them, there are many. So there's no way to divide the graph into two groups that are not very well connected. Like every two groups are well connected. And in particular, there's a thing that like when you walk on an expander graph and you start in a subset, you quickly get out of that subset. And that's a very useful property. So for example, graphs like these are not expanders. Because you could be stuck in one half of it for a long time when you walk and you will not get there. So these are not expanders. The examples of graphs like these are Ramanujan graphs, Cayley graphs. That these are, for example, for shuffling cards. So you start at some point and you use some group element and you can move to other elements, and then by mapping that, you'll get a graph. The important thing is that you want to make these things for any size. So I would want to have a prescription how to make such a graph for n equals 100, n equals 1,000, n equals 10,000. And so that the prescription would be somehow nice and not different for any n and so on. They are explicit, so I have a prescription of how to make them, constant degree approximations to the full graph. A full graph is something that mixes really fast, because from in one step you could be anywhere. This is, you walk, you need to take a couple steps, but you could be pretty much anywhere, even though the degree of each vertex is just a constant. How good a graph, how well expanding a graph is measured by the second largest eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix. So the largest eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix is 1, because when you have a uniform superposition and you walk on this, you're going to stay uniform. That's the mixed part. But when you're not mixed well, the second eigenvector is something that's going to be dying with 1 minus lambda. And the farther the lambda is from 1, the happier we are and the faster it mixes. And an expander is something where this lambda does not depend on n, on the size of the graph, which means that I can have something where the second eigenvector dies with it's like 1 minus or 0.9 for this size, for that size, for that size, and for that size as well. Normally, you would expect that this lambda, like how much the second eigenvector is dying, would be worse and worse with increasing size. But for expanders, it's a constant thing, and that's an important property. To read more about these, Google this review by Hurulinen and Vigdorsson, or if you want to see watch a talk, look at Google Hero Quantum Expanders YouTube. Okay? You'll get a nice talk about expanders. So remember this. Explicit constant degree approximations to the full graph that mix fast. Now let's try to mix up something quantum. It's not really simple to quantize the notion of an expander, but here's an attempt to do something. We would like to have a quantum state and now apply random unitaries to it. If I apply a completely random unitary to a quantum state, it becomes a random state. So this is just like when you're mixing on a graph and you can go from one place to anywhere. Question is, can I have a channel that takes density matrices and now applies at random one out of k out of a set of matrices? So it either applies U1, U2, U3, U4, or UK. Can I have an approximation to this Haar measure from which I took these U's just by taking them out of a small set? So that would be that you give me a quantum state and I choose to do one out of my, say, 10 unitaries, and what I put out is something that's pretty close to mixed. Or if I do this a couple times, I repeat this a couple times, it's going to be very close to the maximally mixed state. So you take the initial state, you do one operation, the other, or the other, weighted by one over k, and sum it up together. That's that channel. So it transforms n by n matrices, and if the matrix, the density matrix, was the maximally mixed state, the identity, that one doesn't change. But if it's anything else, it will get changed. Will change somewhat. How well a quantum expander is working is measured by the second largest singular value of this channel. So this is the 2 norm. And like anything that's orthogonal to the identity, so if you take x that has trace 0, so it's orthogonal to the identity in the trace norm, then once you apply this channel to it, it's going to be dying with this lambda. The farther the lambda is away from 1, the happier we are. And there are examples where we can construct them. So the first paper was that, like, when you choose a few random matrices, that was by Hastings, then this constitutes a quantum expander. But now we also have explicit constructions of these unitaries. So I think of a size n, and then I come up with a couple of unitaries that together make up this quantum expander, and that works for, like, there were constructions for 8 unitaries, 4 unitaries, and now David Gross has something for 3 unitaries. Where when you look at 1 minus lambda, it goes like some k, where k is the number of unitaries, to the minus small constant. So actually, the largest eigenvalue is 1, the largest singular value, and the second singular value is like 1 minus something very small. So it could be like 1 over 2,000 or something. But still, it's a constant. It's something that does not depend on the size of the system that I'm trying to mix. And one of the ways that these are constructed, that they are constructed from classical expanders that come from, you can imagine that you have a group of, you have a 2x2 grid of numbers from 1 to n and 1 to n. And then you imagine that these are coordinates, and you multiply them by one of, say, 3 matrices that move you to a different coordinate place. And then this together will give you a structure of a graph. And that graph classically is an expander. And now what they do, that like they take this multiplication by the matrices and they encode it into unitaries. And somehow this will give you only, say, 3 unitaries at the whole system that together mix things well. Right? So if you want to learn more about this, like look at David Gross and Jens Eisert's paper. And in our work, we will use these 3 unitaries. You cannot do it with 2. You have to have at least 3. How many do you need to like mix very well a state that's just a state of a 1 qubit? Like choose one out of some number of unitaries to really mix it up, what would you use? Paulis, yeah? So just do nothing X, Y, or Z. That really mixes things up. But so if I used 3 on that, maybe it doesn't mix it quite well, but there might be 3. But now we want to have 3 things on a huge system. And that's a surprising thing that that even exists. For 2, you will see it in a bit, and it has something to do with commutation. That there is a way that there's going to be more than one fixed point. So it's not going to be like contracting towards the maximally mixed state. So let's go. Let's look at how does this map behave. So it transforms n by n matrices. So a big N is something like 2 to the little n, where n is the number of qubits. And I take that matrix, I put ui and ui dagger around it, and see what happens. So what's a matrix that does not change under this map? Identity. Yeah? So just identity disappears, UI gets killed with UI dagger, and that's it. That's it. Also, what if X commuted with UI? I could just move it to the side and like get rid of the UIs, and that would stay. Right? However, there for a quantum expander, there is no matrix besides the identity that would commute pretty well with all the UIs. So the UIs are constructed in such a way that there's nobody that commutes with all of them. So if you had just 2, you could make something. Because also, like, you can take, like, if you have U1, U2, U3, you could just as well take, like, identity, and then U2, U1 dagger, and U3, U1 dagger. Something like that. But if you had just 2, then you would have identity and something, and then you could diagonalize that matrix, and that could commute. So now, let's look again, we can discuss this a bit more afterwards, at the states that we're mixing. So this is a density matrix. I will write it out here with XAB being this matrix, these elements, A, B, and these are just registered. There's a bra and there's a ket. Now, let me make a step here. What's the stationary point? It's the maximally mixed state. It's the X equals identity. Now let me reinterpret this system of size n as a system with 2 registers, so n and another n, just by turning this bra into a ket. So now this is a pure state. Right? How does this map look now on these pure states? So if I don't have that, but I have 2 registers, one n register and one n register. So what will happen to these XABs? Well, really, it's if you look at what happened with UI applied to this XAB, here it's going to be UI applied to that register or to this index, and UI star being applied to the other register. This is what I would call a distributive application of an expander, because it's something I can imagine that I have a system that has 2 parts, and UI happens here and UI star happens there. And I choose like 1 out of k of these to do. So at random, I choose do something in sync. While here, it just was like I was applying it to the density matrix on one register. So I do that. Now, what is the stationary state now? What is the X? Yeah, it's the X is identity. That's the only stationary state. And what state is that? It's just sum of XX over all X. So that's the maximally entangled state. So just by doing the trick, like changing one bra to one ket, so, and we had a stationary state that was maximally mixed, in a different interpretation, in a two-register system, the only state that stays unchanged is the maximally entangled state. And that's going to be the thing that we're going to use, because we will try to apply an expander distributively on 2 parts of a system, and if the system doesn't change, it means the system was maximally entangled. So that will be our tool for the second part of the talk. Any questions? Okay, yeah?
So, in the classical case, if you apply an expander to any point, or to any initial distribution, you converge to the limiting distribution, which is uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have a spectral gap. Does it mean that if you apply it many times, you convert to the
maximally mixed state.
Maximally mixed state.
Mm-hmm. Or here, we're going to say, in this two-resistor interpretation, we will show that this guy, this map, is actually close to a projector on the maximally entangled state.
Wait, so it's not convergent.
So in that way, it's not going to be converging. It's going to be like that part that was. It can become a measurement, right? That like either it will die or it will stay. That's what we're going to use it as something like to check whether something is entangled or not. So I don't think that we can just directly use it to like take any state and actually entangle it. But maybe there would be a way.
This operator, the average of all ui times ui star,
mm-hmm.
that I don't think that needs to be unitary in general.
Probably
so,
not.
So how do you implement it? I mean, it's just some arbitrary operator that you're implementing on a pure state. So I guess you can only do it probabilistically.
I'll show you what we'll do. It's so actually, I will actually apply it in superposition for something. So you can imagine that you just say that like, okay, let's throw a random number and then apply UI here and UI star here. Mm-hmm. It's the same as just applying UI or UI star UI dagger to this density matrix with one register. So there is some randomness in there. So you're choosing to do one out of k random operations, and the operations now are not a walk, but now they're a unitary. All right, you'll see it in a bit.
I'm sorry. Again, you're saying that if you applied it to x,
mm-hmm.
not in the other representation, original representation, mm-hmm. then you converge to the maximum extent or not? I didn't really understand that.
I think you should.
If you apply this here, it should also be in the second representation. They're equivalent. So it's as if you apply it many times, you start with arbitrary thing, and you end up with the maximally mixed state, which is very strange. I mean, I don't see any contradiction. It's non-unitary, but I just don't see what happened. I don't understand what's happening.
Okay, I'll have to think about it some more. Let's get back to that. But so normally, but with the mixing thing, like you start somewhere and you keep applying like random unitaries to it, you'll get to a random place. Does that sound all right? But now in. But for someone, okay. So for someone who doesn't know what I did, but it's enough to take a reasonable number of steps to actually mix it up for somebody that doesn't know.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who doesn't know what you did
mm-hmm.
just knows it's gone from the set. They won't know what you got. So that's what I mean. The rules, maybe the rules. You haven't given us the explicit rules yet. Maybe when you do it, it will become clearer.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go on and then get back to you. So here, in this interpretation on these pure states, now this is close to the depolarizing channels, to the projector on the maximally entangled state. And we can show that it's close, like the smaller the lambda is, the better we're doing. Okay. Now what we're going to do it, use it for a dynamical protocol to test entanglement. So here's the protocol. I'm first ask you, imagine that like that half of the room and that half of the room, you are sharing a lot of EPR pairs. How do you certify that you have them? What would you do? So you look at those guys and like they look at you and like you say like, we have EPR pairs. Can we check it? How do you check it? All right, so you have n things and you... So what happens to the states that you have did the Bell measurements? You sacrifice them. They
sacrifice some to do it. That's mm-hmm. one way to do it.
And you also have to like send a lot of messages on the other side, like basically as many as you tested, right? Any other? There is a way to do it without sacrificing them, and there is a way to do it by sending across only like when this is big N, then log n qubits, and then log 1 over lambda, where lambda is like an error with what you're willing to tolerate in the certification. So it's still something that's like much better than just doing the Bell measurements. It's in a paper by Charlie Bennett and others as a side thing. But what we do, we're going to do something where you're going to send across qubits that, or the number of qubits that actually does not depend on the size of the system. So we're just going to send something that depends on the error that we're willing to tolerate. And in particular, we're just going to send one qutrit across.
What kind of level of promise do you want after the test? That if you pass the test, then what?
Mm-hmm. So my promise is going to be like, if these were maximally entangled, then I'm going to say that they are maximally entangled.
Yeah.
And if they were not maximally entangled, then the probability that I will declare them maximally entangled is constant away from one. And I can repeat it a couple times and basically like get as good as I want.
Because I'm not sure what happens if you just pick a, suppose we have lots of states.
Right.
And you pick a constant number of them and do CHSH over this constant number. How good is that?
So we will do better. I don't know what the, you can calculate it, right?
Yeah, I don't know how good it is, but part of it is
like if you choose
randomly which ones you use so that you can't get skewed and all the ones you didn't pick are the ones that aren't.
Mm-hmm. Ashwin?
So there has to be some randomness in there.
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know how good it is, but you asked for a method.
Yeah. And that was a method. It's a good method. Yeah. I'm talking about this one, but I can locally transform them. So if I was...
I've already realized that you've just got Bell pairs, they're not connected naturally, and you will have to transform.
Right. Yeah. But we can do that. Just by deciding, we claim that we have something else, so then you transform it to that one and certify that one, and you can transform it back. All that I'm asking now about is like, how much communication does there need to be in between? And we say a qutrit of quantum communication. So what we will do, we will apply the quantum expander distributively. So we will apply UIs here and UI dagger stars on the other side in sync. And the way to do it, we will start with a qutrit in a uniform superposition, 1 plus 2 plus 3. Then we'll have it interact with one side of the system. Then we'll send the qutrit across. And controlled on the state of the qutrit, we'll apply the UI star on the other side in a controlled way. And then we'll look at what happened to the qutrit. And if the qutrit stayed uniform, it means that these guys were maximally entangled in this way. The reason why this works is this. That imagine that that was the original state, and I'm adding a qutrit in a superposition to it. And then controlled on the qutrit, I'm basically applying UI to the left and UI star on the right. And now if the XAB is identity, then I know that this thing doesn't do anything. So these UIs just go away, and the qutrit stays unchanged. So while it's like, something happens to the side, but when it comes back, it does something on the other side, and the qutrit gets unentangled from the system. It just falls out. So it works for the maximally entangled state, and now for any other state that's not the maximally entangled state, we get soundness from the quantum expander property. Because no state with some other matrix X will commute with all of the U's, and it will mean that in the end, the probability that we will actually measure 0 plus 1 or 1 plus 2 plus 3 on that qutrit that comes out is going to be a constant away from 1 for states orthogonal to that one. So the message length is constant, and the probability of being fooled is a constant as well, independent of the size of the system. Right.
In the qubit case, it's enough to measure sigma x, sigma z,
Yeah, so we are really doing something non-local, but just with a constant size of connection. While you might think that like you need to do something much bigger. And even like the smallest thing that we could get possibly, so here the three was because of the three unitaries for the smallest expander that we could get. And the slimmest protocol that we could get is with you share, first share 2 bits of randomness to choose one out of 4 unitaries to do. Like, are we going to do U1, U2, U3, or U4, say? Or just, or maybe 1 out of 3. And you start with a plus qubit, and then you either apply it, apply the UI or don't, send it on the other side, and either apply UI star or don't, and then look at whether this became a plus. So some yeah. So we see, did something happen or did something not happen, right? So this is the smallest protocol that we get. To sum it up, we have little communication, local tests, so local measurement on one side, and we get a constant error probability to certify global correlations in a system in a dynamical way. So it's like you send something, interact, send, interact, measure. Now we're going to turn to a static picture, where I'm going to look at the counterexample to the generalized area law, where I'm going to look at correlations and entanglement between subsystems. And what I expect that when I have a system where there's not many connections, the interactions are local, and there is a constant gap, means that the ground state and the excited states are separated by a gap that's constant independent on the size of the system, so this works for any size, then you would expect that the ground state has only local correlations. That's something that we think. Well, it turns out that these correlations can be global, and I'm going to give you an example of that. So let me tell you what it's going to be and why the area law is interesting for me and why we were trying to look at how it looks in general geometries. So when you look at ground states of spin systems that are gapped, then when you look at, you divide it into 2 subsystems, and you look at the entanglement entropy of the subsystem, then the entropy does not scale like the volume, but it scales like the surface area, or, so that's why it's area, or it's actually the surface of the subsystem. Specifically, like say in 1D, the surface is just a constant. So it tells you that like how the correlation, that there's not much correlations. If you increase the subsystem size, actually the correlations should not grow much, especially when you have a system that's gapped. And when there's not much correlation, then you could hope for a simpler description of the system. So when there's an area law instead of a volume law, you expect a simpler ground state and then possibly some numerics to work. So which Hamiltonians are gapped in 1D? So like when you increase the size of the system, the excited states don't get close or just stop somewhere. So one thing that that I know is like the AKLT spin chain, that has a gap. Or when you, for those guys that like walks, so like when you have a walk in 1D, but you bias it by some number, that will give you a constant gap. What other things with a constant gap do you know? Yep. And for quantum ones, sometimes it is hard to determine whether a system, like as the size increases, is gapped or not. That's what Toby Cubitt has a paper on. It actually is a really difficult problem to determine that for some models, but not in 1D. I would like to get it in 1D. I think they have it in 2D. If my interactions are... Well, you could have constant, just nearest neighbor interactions and still not have a gapped system. So specifically, like say that I have the Heisenberg model, then the excited states are like 1 over n squared away, I think. So the gap closes with the size of the system. Or when you have critical systems, then the gap closes. So say the transverse Ising model when it's properly tuned. All right, but still, for gapped Hamiltonians, in our experience, we see fall-off of correlations that exponential, and we know that it happens in 1D. And then when you have correlations that fall down exponentially, then matrix product states, DMRG, they work really well, so we're happy with our numerics. So one thing that we still need to remember, if there is no gap, or if the gap is very, very small, the entropy in the ground state, the entanglement, can be really huge. For example, if you have an interaction like this that prefers singlets, prefers 0, 1, minus 1, 0, but it really prefers it here, and then less here, less here, less here, less here, and less here, the ground state of a system like this is actually singlet here, singlet here, singlet here, singlet here, singlet there. So it has a lot of entanglement in the ground state. But you can change things only slightly, you'll get to the first excited state that does not have much entanglement. Possibly. So just when the gap is small, anything can happen. But if the gap is large, we expect simple ground states. So gap systems to get an area law. And we would, so in 1D we have a theorem where we have the area law, and we have the algorithms. We have algorithms that we know that work very well, and we have an algorithm that people don't use, but actually is provably good. In 2D, we're close to the area law. So we don't have something that just goes with the surface, but it goes like some slightly higher exponent. And now, what happens in general geometry? What would the area law look like there? And does it hold or not? So imagine that I have a system that has general connections, and now I would divide it in half, and say that I would conjecture that the entropy, entanglement entropy, for a subsystem would grow with this cut size, with like how many links did I break? So that would be, the conjecture would be like, when I have a gap, there are a few links between the subsystems, the terms are not like exponentially falling, but they're just all order one or something, so I don't have like really strong or really weak terms. Then there should not be much entanglement between the subsystems in the ground state. That would be the conjecture. And what we show that this is not true, and this is not true in a system like that with a single connection between the subsystems. So let me present that. First, I'll start with a system that's slightly simpler. So it's going to be a system with four particles that has a large particle, and qutrit, and a qutrit. Here, the Hamiltonian is going to be gapped. It's going to be frustration-free, meaning that like all the terms in the Hamiltonian 1, 2, and 3 are going to be happy. So they're going to be projectors, and they're going to be satisfied in the ground state, project to 0. And the interaction between these middle things is order 1, so it's just going to be constant size. And the ground state is going to be unique and very entangled. And when I cut it in half, it's going to be very entangled with entanglement entropy R of n, where n is the size of this particle. That's what I'm going to show you. The construction goes like this. First, I'll write a projector PL on these two particles, on the big one and a small one, so that the ground state has this form. 1 on this guy, and x here. And then when this is a 2, then this is ax. And when that is a 3, that has to be bx, where identity B, A, and B are three matrices for a quantum expander. So let's look at what do these look like. As a vector, just with J being this guy, Y being that guy, then this part corresponds to 1, this part corresponds to 2, and this part corresponds to 3, and that X is what happens here, AX here, BX here. So that's as a vector. And now if I just wrote the ground states as like a matrix which has the ix and jy as indices, it would look like this. So every vector in this matrix has a form, has this form. Well, these are ground states of this form, with their components written out as a matrix. So that's the matrix Psi Ix Jy. Now I'll use the second projector here on the right side, where I'll use the ground state. That's probably the only one that I'm going to write here. Just look at that, and now you can turn it off.
Okay.
I won't write anything more, I promise. So now on the right side, I'll have this form. So when this is a 1, this is some y. When this is a 2, it's a of y. When this is a 3, this has to be b of y. So as a vector, now as a row vector, it's going to look like this. Any I, any x, and for a particular y, when this is a 1, then this is ya when this is a 2, and yb when this is a 3. And as a matrix, it has that form. So just every row has that particular form, and y1, y2, and y3 are just generic matrices. Now let's put it together, these two things that we had for PL and PR. When you put those vectors on top of each other, there has to be some matrix in the top corner, and then those two become AX and XI, BX and XB, and whatever in there. So those are the ground states of PL plus PR. And now I'm going to join them in the middle by a projector PM that has a specific form, and the form is I enforce symmetry between 1-2 and 2-1 and 1-3 and 3-1. Maybe I'll have to write one more, or maybe I won't. Do you know how to enforce this symmetry? What the projector will look like on these two things? It will be like a projector on 1-2 minus 2-1. And a projector on 1-3 minus 3-1 on the middle. And it tells you that if you want to be a ground state and satisfy that projector, then when there's a 1 and there's a 2 here, the state has to have the same thing for 2 here and 1 here. So that means that this block has to be the same as that block. And this block has to be the same as that block. So what does that mean? Commutation. So who commutes with A and B? Well, nobody, except for the identity. So once X is an identity, everything works very well, and that's the ground state. So this is the ground state. And anybody else that does not have the identity here has an energy that is at least a constant away from zero. And we can show that. And that comes from the expander property that basically there's nobody that commutes with A and B an identity. So that's it. We have a Hamiltonian that has a gap. And this state is very entangled. Can you see that? If it was just this identity in the corner, it would be the maximally entangled state. And now it has just a couple more blocks. It doesn't really matter. Or you can transform it into something that's just very entangled. So we have a unique, a very entangled ground state. For a Hamiltonian that has a gap and has terms of norm O1, there are just these three projectors, it's frustration-free. The one thing that's kind of unrealistic about it, that like these things are not qubits or qutrits, they are n-dimensional particles. So now I'm going to make this example local. So I'm going to divide it into qubits. And the way to do it is that, how do I rewrite this projector on an n by 3 system into something that goes with qubits? Like, how do I even just think of enforcing this type of form of ground state? So one thing that we can do, we know that we can write a quantum circuit that takes this state and prepares that state. So it takes like 1 plus 2 plus 3 on x, and then depending on whether this is a 2, apply A, and if it's 3, apply B. So we can write a circuit for that. And we can also prepare a history state for the computation of this circuit with Kitaev's construction. And once we have this history state, we can write Kitaev's Hamiltonian, whose ground state is going to be the history state.
And the constructions, I forgot, like Gossett, Gross and someone else was efficient.
Yeah, that's those are the three unitaries.
But yeah. It's three unitaries that can be efficiently implemented.
Yeah, that can be, yes, that can be decomposed into a circuit. Yeah, so we actually have this. So I will divide this large particle into qubits on a line, say, and I will use Kitai's local Hamiltonian to simulate that this PL. It's not going to be PL exactly, but it's going to be a project or a Hamiltonian whose ground state is going to be the history of the computation, where the result of the computation is going to be of that form. And I'm actually run the computation for a bit and then leave it for a long time. So the ground state is going to be pretty much mostly that. So it's actually like start with that guy, and then as the clock goes forward, I compute it, and then I've computed it, so I have that, and then I have that for many, many, many more terms. So altogether, the ground state of this new Hamiltonian is going to be that tensor, a lot of clock states. The price that we pay for that, well, when we do something like this, is, because when you write this history state and you do that with the Kitaios Hamiltonian, let's say in this fashion, just to recall that I want a Hamiltonian applied to history state to be a zero, and the history state is, this is the computation as it goes on in time with the clock there, then I need to write, say, two local conditions on eight-dimensional particles, say, where I will look at how the clock is encoded, whether this is properly initialized, whether the state when it's in a particle state goes on to the next state as well, and then also I want to check whether at the end, whether most of the state has the result. So here, like my gates for most of the computation is going to be identity at the end. So the ground state is going to be stuff, and most of the time the result. The price you pay for this is that the gap of this part, it's not going to be PL anymore, it's going to be Hamiltonian on the left, is 1 over polynomial in n. The gap for Kitaios Hamiltonian is like 1 over the number of gates squared. So we've lost the property that we have a gapped Hamiltonian. So what will we do? We'll just take that and we will multiply that by n squared. So we will use interactions that are super strong. And that's an easy thing, like you have a Hamiltonian that has a small gap, like you rescale the Hamiltonian, suddenly the gap goes back up, right? But that's cheating. But look at that, we did not rescale the middle part. We just rescaled the sides. So the interaction between the subsystems stayed a constant size. And now what we will do, these super strong interactions that are polynomial strength, we will decompose them into many, many, many little interactions with many, many extra qubits. So that's another contribution, another trick that we can write gadgets that takes an interaction that's strong between two qubits and they decompose it into many interactions that are weak between many qubits. So that's something that we didn't know how to do before, because before, when you actually wanted to have an interaction of something through an intermediary, you had to use stronger interactions and even stronger interactions here to generate something effective here. But now we can do something slightly different, that you actually use many, many weak interactions to generate something that's strong here. So that's in a paper with Yudong Cao, so that's on an archive, and we are promising very soon an updated version with many errors corrected in that, but it still works very well. So we trade huge couplings in this Hamiltonian for small couplings, but we introduce many more spins and the degree of the graph becomes huge. So before that it was a line, now it's a mess and a mess that's connected by a single link in the middle. And that's that. So in the end we will have a Hamiltonian that has like n times like a lot of other qubits, and n and a lot of other qubits, qutrit in between here. The interactions are two-body, but they're not quite local. It's a really a weird geometry. Yeah.
So is the degree not a constant?
So the degree is polynomial. Yeah. So it's not constant anymore. The gap stays constant. And the terms are O1 or smaller norm, and the Hamiltonian is frustrated, but the ground state is pretty much this guy. So it's still like what we had there, tensor, a lot of stuff on the ancillas where the stuff is pretty much zeros. So that's the final thing that we produce. And the question that we have, what to do with it now, is that we're asking what happens, and we have this calculated, what happens when you make the middle chain slightly longer, and at some point it actually just becomes again like a 1D thing. And then we want to figure out what would happen if on the sides we didn't have this weird geometry, but if we had a nice lattice, and we don't know whether we can keep it, whether we can make it, whether we can apply this expander, these circuits, whether we can do it on a nice lattice, and whether the area law would actually hold all lattices and not just not in these weird geometries. Or then another idea is that just to come up with a different area conjecture, that would be like you would be counting not only the number of things you've cut, but also the number of things that are nearby. So then for us, it's like we're here, and then suddenly there are many things nearby already. So there's nothing like that a signal from here has to take a certain time to reach other qubits. It very quickly reaches a lot of qubits in the other subsystem. So maybe we could have like some kind of a geometrical measure of that. Yeah?
Can you go back to the previous, can you explain what you just
did? So can I have a system where I would have an interaction between two particles, and then this interacting with particles that would be on a lattice? So there will be interactions only like that. So no interaction with everybody.
So let's say a 2D lattice.
Yeah, let's say a 2D lattice. So could something like what we have just shown work in a system like this as well?
This would be a counterexample to the area law, to
yeah.
The second 2D area
law. Yeah. And we are trying to figure out, like, can we do this, or what are the reasons why we cannot do this, and so on. And for example, some of the questions that we're asking, like, can these expanders be done with a circuit that's only like a small depth, or does this decomposition have to be like really large, and that has to do with like how much we have to rescale, and so on. Yep.
Then you used gadget which destroyed your geometry, right? That was the problem. So can you explain again? I would have imagined that the gadgets are local. You take a constraint and then you put some gadgets that only touches that these two qubits.
Right. But I actually put a lot of them in there. It's something of this type. So there's actually plenty of these here. So if this had strength that was like n squared, then I have to introduce like n squared qubits in there, or polynomial of n squared. It might be like n to the fifth or something.
And what do you, just to give us a hint, what's going on there?
You know, you can pretty much imagine a full graph.
I see.
So it's in some way, like if you know something about the gadgets, they're like the middle thing that it's done by perturbation theory. When you take a system and you fix it very strongly, and you also, so the ground state is really like this guy being zero, but then you also have a slight interaction with these two things on the side, so you can generate an effective interaction here, okay? But here this guy being fixed strongly can be replaced by the guy interacting with a lot of things that are fixed. So I actually have like a full graph of ferromagnetic interactions where like the things seem to be like really locked together. So that's one thing that you can see here. That's what we call a core, and like these qubits are connected to them, so they really don't want to flip. And then also then we decompose, then we have a parallelization thing where you can take, instead of just one thing, you can take many of them together. So you can decompose something strong into many, many weaker ones. And the trick is how to make sure that the perturbation series converges and so on. So to end up here, I try to give you examples of quantum expanders and try to convince you that they are an interesting thing, that you can use them to mix things up and check entanglement between parts of the system without much communication. And then the second thing, that they give you power to construct very strange counterexamples or very strange Hamiltonians that have very entangled ground states, even though you wouldn't expect it, because the Hamiltonians are gapped. gapped Hamiltonian, constant gap, or a constant size of the communication was the thing that came from a constant number of unitaries in the quantum expander. So that's for today. Thank you for your attention. Now we can freely discuss or go home.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. We have time for questions if there are any more.
So can you tell me what the other things do? Because I think I don't know much about that.
Well, neither do I know that much, but they're used to approximate sampling from random distributions. And the K or the T, depending on, I mean, it's just notation convention, is something to do with the size of the distribution or how well you're sampling.
Or is it like for how many uses of that?
So if you want to approximate the random distribution, but you're only going to do a finite number of samples, that's the K of the Q. And there's quantum versions of this that Aaron Rupert was working on. I'm thinking it's not a coincidence he's now doing his standards.
Right, but I think what he told me that like it doesn't have much together besides Aaron working on that.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean?
Yeah.
Can you explain it? So what does the one in the one design mean?
Can anyone define?
Can you say that?
Like imagine like having like K systems.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The exact same unitary and average over part measure. And imagine doing the same thing with some other like unitaries and other measures. And if they coincide together, then it's a key unitary key. And you can play the other games with some projectors, projecting on particular states. Yeah. Those are key designs as well. So I think what she had in mind was a unitary key design.
Any other comments, questions?
Any other questions?
Adam?
So the interaction term in this area, got these two things, there's an interaction.
Yep.
So what happens if you sort of start, there you go, it's increase the strength. So I'm thinking of like bringing two of these from far away.
Mm-hmm. So basically, somehow, like, what if this guy was? What is when I'm ruling out that I was not enforcing it like fully, but just in a weak way or something. Then I think I would be losing the power that like the thing though would not have a constant gap, that it would. Depending on whether if this was a constant strength, then the gap is a constant. If the strength was like 1/poly, then the gap in the system would be like 1/poly as well.
But let's say we're varying the strength, right?
Yeah.
Taking two of these like really far apart, mm-hmm. and bringing them closer together,
so we're starting to enforce the symmetry as we bring them closer. Well, I don't know what would happen. Then the ground state changes, but I don't know what the dynamics of the system would be, because this would be like a dynamical thing. Like I have them far apart and I know what the ground state is, and then I start to bring them close together. Will they thermalize or something, or how will this behave? I don't know. Yeah, might be fun to try.
Okay. Anything else? Not, then let's thank Daniel again.